Welcome to The Breach Show, featuring sharp analysis on politics and social movements in Canada. I'm your host, Katia Lowinnis. Last week, Alberta Premier Danielle Smith announced a sweeping set of policies under the banner of gender identity and parental rights. They represent the latest and most extreme attack on trans rights in Canada. To speak with us about this development and the current rise of transphobia, our guest today is Celeste Triannon. Celeste is a trans activist, law student, and legal clinic coordinator based in Montreal. She's the creator of the Quebec Trans ID Clinic, a virtual drop-in service for individuals wishing to change their legal name and gender marker, and has also done pop-up clinics in Nova Scotia. Welcome to the show, Celeste.
Thank you very much.
Let's just start by talking about Alberta. Can you break down for us what policy changes Danielle Smith's UCP government is bringing in?
Yeah, but just to preface everything, this is very much the biggest attacks on young people's human rights that Canada has seen in the 21st century. It is by far one of the biggest attacks on healthcare, on education, and on so many other things that are happening all at the same time, all in the name of appealing to a disinformation loving base. First and foremost, there are healthcare bans, measures taken specifically against the scientific consensus in order to forbid the use of hormone therapy, puberty blockers, etc. Medication that's been proven to be life-saving and that can reduce lifetime suicide ideation by over 73% when taken by trans youth. They're trying to remove that. They're also trying to remove access to gender-affirming surgeries for minors, which, of course, has become a hot-button topic in politics, but de facto is practically never being given except for mastectomies, which do contain a lower degree of risk. So that's for healthcare. For education, it's even more prejudice-based policies. It's just, for example, denying trans youth and only trans youth the right to use the name of their choice, the pronouns of their choice, etc., before age 16, unless their parents explicitly consent, which de facto is a parental veto. And even for older teens, it's trying to require parental notification, which is also going to lead to situations where youth and young people are being forcibly outed to their parents, putting them at risk in extreme circumstances for homelessness. Of course, you also have other aspects that do not just impact trans people, such as, for example, trying to forbid the teaching of any sexual education, which includes information about child abuse, consent, etc., all these fundamental concepts that is also being attacked. And finally, there's also prejudice-based attacks on trans women's participation in sports, which at the end of the day, it shouldn't be regulated by politicians. It should be regulated by sports agencies and associations themselves.
It's definitely a very severe and draconian policy. It is a very, very severe limiting on the rights of young people. I grew up in Ontario, and I remember when the Ford government was announcing they were going to have cuts on sex education, there was a huge outcry. And even the fact that sex education is now opted in Alberta, that's being buried under all of this. It was just a very, very bad policy change.
Exactly.
Just to recap for people listening, it's the big ones are, yeah, banning on all gender-affirming surgeries at top and bottom for minors age 17 and under, prohibiting puberty blockers and hormone therapy for youth 15 and under, unless they've started the treatment, parental consent for any pronoun or name change under 18. Yeah, and then also the ban on trans girls and women athletes from participating in competitive sports. So she unveiled these policies in this like very strange 7-minute long video. It's like full of twangy guitar music. She's standing in front of a painting of the prairies. There's a lot of stock footage of teens hanging out. Let me just play you a clip.
I understand how controversial and divisive discussions on topics of sexuality and gender can be, especially when those conversations involve children. I would therefore ask that as we work through implementing these policies, that we, as adults in this province, do all we can to depoliticize the discussion and focus on the well-being of the children involved.
My first reaction is, I like truly cannot believe they spent money on this. But what was your reaction to what Smith is saying?
Of course. I mean, it's understandable that politicians want to have children's best interests at heart. But at the end of the day, the Danielle Smith policies run completely contrary to that. Kids' best interests, teenagers' best interests. That is something which does not necessarily hinge on politicians' decisions. Instead, it hinges on science, it hinges on so much more as well. Making sure that all youth, young people get all the well-being that they deserve, have like all the conditions necessary for them to be able to grow up and thrive as later down the line as adults. These are things which can vary from one teen to another. And the LGBT policies run completely contrary to that. It's not depolitization, it's instead polarization. It is an attack, an assault on young people's human rights that is probably not going to withstand a charter challenge. That I'm going to say almost certainly. It's in a way draconian and runs completely contrary to that. If Danielle Smith wanted to depoliticize the discussion, she would leave it up to doctors to administer healthcare, education professionals to administer education, and perhaps leave it up to like sex therapists and other professionals who already know like at what age it's appropriate to talk about a given topic.
I think it's even just ironic the choice of word depoliticization that she's using in this massive video that she's obviously spent a lot of resources on, which is the exact opposite of depoliticizing it. She's very much politicizing it and making it like a tenet of her premiership.
Exactly. Danielle Smith will most likely be remembered for this. It's because of how egregious of an attack it is. There's been protests against her all across the country, from Kelowna all the way to Newfoundland. There's been protests against Danielle Smith's policies everywhere, and everywhere Danielle Smith has gone, there's been protests. There was one in Ottawa on Monday, in Toronto on Tuesday. For obvious reason, people are angry and righteously so.
This is obviously something that's not just impacting people in Alberta, it's going to impact people across Canada. You've created this map that comprehensively tracks the policies by each province that impact trans people, which people can see on your website, celeste.lgbt, which I'll make sure to link in the description. What are the implications of what's happening in Alberta for the rest of trans people in Canada?
I'd say, first and foremost, Danielle Smith managed to open up a Pandora's box, and we're seeing Pierre Poilievre and the federal conservatives starting to like openly look inside and try to like take its contents out. These policies are not going to stick only to Alberta. One thing's for sure, there's going to be an increasing division between different Canadian jurisdictions, provinces, with regards to trans-affirming policies and anti-trans policies. For example, we might end up seeing anti-trans healthcare policies implemented in Saskatchewan, in New Brunswick, and like jurisdictions where there are more conservative premiers and legislative assemblies. So that is, of course, going to be a pretty significant risk. There's also a likelihood that transmigration, trans people moving between one province and another, that is going to change. For example, I'm talking about trans people, especially trans youth and their families, being forced to move from, say, Alberta into BC, or from Saskatchewan to Manitoba. We're going to see more cross-provincial migration caused specifically by anti-trans legislation. This is really frightening and sort of parallels what's been happening with the U.S., with most people fleeing anti-trans states. I believe right now more than 80% of the trans population in Florida is trying to quit the state, which goes to show how much these draconian policies, which can, I'm not sure if like saying apartheid would be a good comparison, but I believe we're getting pretty close to that, like at least with regard to trans issues. It would push people to move elsewhere. It is why Canada has had an influx. So trans people moving from one country to another, including from the US, both from countries from the global south and the so-called global north. We're seeing the consequences like so much more widely. And I'm afraid that where is that going to bring us if the federal conservatives end up getting elected and there's federal anti-trans policies and legislation being introduced? That would set a horrible precedent.
I didn't know that people in Florida were trying to move. I knew that there was a travel ban in Florida that the Canadian government had issued, which is interesting considering how things are shaping up. Migrations due to like provincial repressive policies have happened, I think, in the case of Quebec with, I think, it's Bill 21.
Exactly.
The anti-hijabi bill.
Even if it's just on a case-by-case basis, for example, teachers move to Ontario because they can no longer teach in Quebec as a hijabi person. That is, even though it is at a more micro scale, at the same time, it is setting a dangerous precedent for what comes next.
On the topic of precedents, there's been anti-trans bills in New Brunswick and also Saskatchewan, and Alberta's policies come only a few months after Saskatchewan's policies. Their conservative premier, Scott Moe, passed the Parents' Rights Bill, which bans students from using their chosen name or preferred pronouns at school without parental consent. And his government was able to push forward this policy using Section 33 of the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms, which is known by policy nerds as the notwithstanding clause. It allows governments to override parts of the charter, including articles on human rights. Using the clause was taboo for a very long time, but it's recently been put to use almost exclusively by conservative premiers. So Doug Ford used it twice, and recently in 2022 to try to force Ontario education workers back to work. So Celeste, given that Mo has been able to push his legislation forward using this notwithstanding clause, what do you think are the odds of Smith doing so too?
I'd say if Smith wants any chance of that legislation standing the test of the courts, especially that organizations such as Skipping Stone and Young Canada are already committing to suing, there will need to be the notwithstanding clause for any chance, because this is exactly legislation that the charter was designed to prevent. We're talking about the same legislation, the same family as Canada's historical anti-Asian migration acts, oppressive policies under the so-called Indian Act, and other such oppressive legislation designed specifically to treat minorities as second-class citizens. The charter was introduced as a means to prevent that. But now we're seeing more and more with Quebec Bill 21 and 96, with Bill 137 in Saskatchewan, and now with Alberta's policies and all that, it's likely we're going to start seeing this dismantling of the rule of law and of the very way Canadian democracy has been sustained over the last 40-something years, all over the rights of minorities and especially the rights of young people.
We're seeing this clause being used to override the rights of minorities.
We can see all these conservative premiers are enacting it to attack minority rights, attack workers' rights, attack the rights of trans people, which is, yeah, as you mentioned, very scary.
This would be hypothetically not the first time that Alberta's used it, because I think it was used to try and block gay marriage a couple of years ago. So I just want to loop back to something we talked about a bit earlier when we're talking about Florida, and the fact that a lot of these policies in Canada are being influenced or coming in the wake of America's anti-trans and anti-2S LGBTQ plus laws. According to the Trans Legislation Tracker, a whooping 503 bills were introduced last year. That's like more than one bill per day. That's compared to 148 the year before. So only 85 of those bills were actually passed, only 85. But it's a startling jump to what we've seen before. How does what's happening in America affect us here in Canada? Or are there also any like homegrown anti-trans developments happening in Canada anyway?
I'd say there's a lot of foreign influence on Canadian anti-trans politics, whether it be from the US or from the UK or from like many other countries as such. And oftentimes, I'd say the one element that's the most shared between Canada and these other countries is the rhetoric. The rhetoric used by anti-trans groups is very similar. They used to not be really able to catch on, but they've managed to create a vocabulary, a set of keywords that has managed to, in a way, buy away the hearts of unsuspecting parents and making sure that they would be vocally opposed to trans rights despite that being clearly against their kids' best interests. For example, we're talking about words such as indoctrination, such as quote-unquote gender ideology, such as quote-unquote grooming, you know, all of these terms. They've only become mainstream in the last 2 years, really. And it's because of American far-right groups using these terms more and more, and these terms now getting picked up by the media, etc., up to a point where nowadays it's become an inescapable mainstay of anti-trans politics. That's why you see groups such as Take Back Alberta, such as Save Canada, such as Action for Canada, these groups which all take on the same rhetoric, the same language, in order to push similar policies. So even though the Canadian legislative context is different, nonetheless, they're using the same tactics in order to push for the same things.
And these are also tactics that I think we've seen in the 60s and 70s when there was like a gay and lesbian rights movement. There was a lot of, I think, pushback in America and Canada about queer people being teachers. And there was the exact same rhetoric of grooming and seeing queer people as predatory towards children. So it's kind of mirroring and coming back. It's coming back in vogue, unfortunately.
Yeah, sadly. And that's saying, like, too, a lot of the groups that have been at the center of all this are actually Canadian homegrown groups as well. They're people who are actively trying to influence Canadian politics in order to impose what could, even be considered like an American-style theocracy, which is really frightening if you're asking me.
It's very frightening. And I watched a clip of Daniel Smith on CTV's Power Play with Vasily Kapelos. And even in that interview, I think the host asked Daniel Smith if this was a decision made because groups like Take Back Alberta are becoming such strong factions within UCP, and they're pushing farther right and right within the party. And as we've also seen in Alberta and in BC and across Canada, we also have parties like the NDP that are pushing closer to the center as a way to kind of like balance out, in a sense, the far right turn that the Conservatives are having, and leaving not a lot in the left, which is very scary.
Take Back Alberta has basically control now over the UCP grassroots. So I'm pretty sure they have played a major role in making sure Danielle Smith would pass such policies, even though like she was traditionally known as a libertarian and not someone who you'd expect to pass these. So it probably was also a move of self-preservation on her part. Sadly, one that would end up causing great harm to young people.
Very interesting that she has been historically very libertarian and is going forward with this like policy that requires a lot of government intervention and oversight. On the topic of things that are homegrown, so we're both based in Quebec. For those of you listening who aren't from Quebec, 2 years ago in, oh my gosh, no, 3 years ago in 2021, the CAQ government tried to pass Bill 2. So this was a family law bill that was actually pretty broad and had a lot of laws and reforms around family law and surrogacy, but also gender identity. And this bill was immediately decried as transphobic because it was. It would require individuals wishing to change the sex assigned on their birth certificate to undergo bottom surgery, among other provisions. But the transphobic elements of Bill 2 weren't passed or included in the final bill. And there was a huge mobilization, Celeste, of which you were part of. And yeah, the requirements were stricken from the law. So as one of the organizers against the bill, just like, yeah, tell us a bit about what it was like organizing.
Just to preface this, we don't know yet like why these anti-trans parts of the bill were introduced in the first place, but my personal theory, which I believe is the one that makes the most sense after consulting with my law professors who have been involved in the drafting of said bill, was that the government ended up consulting anti-trans groups fairly extensively. So notably our local TERF group, Pour les droits des femmes du Québec, which has led to having exactly these anti-trans policies be part of like their attempt to comply with the prior judgment, which has demanded that the Quebec government legalize non-binary identities on birth certificates. So that's the context. And the mobilization itself was very rapid. It was quite intense, I'll be honest. I was the person who like actually took the first step, if I'm correct, and ended up getting everyone across the province to like meet up quickly in order to start denouncing the policy, starting to act up quickly. And within 1 week of the bill being introduced, there was already like a National Assembly petition, many other campaigns being drafted up at the grassroots level, protests being organized. Basically, every single organization in the city almost went with a drop everything and come to the emergency room immediately type of stuff because of how urgent the situation was. And we fought, we made it basically politically untenable for the government to actually introduce these anti-trans policies. So they listened. They withdrew all the anti-trans parts of the bill, and eventually it led us to a point where they listened to trans community members, redrafted up the bill in a way that complies with human rights law, and even listened to some of our additional demands, notably with regards to reducing the financial barriers to name and gender market changes, which have been successful. I'll be honest, though, I'm not sure if this would be possible in 2024, though, because since last year, there's been so much more anti-trans hate everywhere to the point where the very idea of quote-unquote trans rights or human rights is no longer something that can be taken for granted.
As an organizer, what do you know is happening in Alberta? And do you think a victory like this could happen in Alberta or Saskatchewan or New Brunswick or any other province where there's anti-trans laws?
Yeah, I'd say definitely the mobilization in Alberta this time is way larger than like when it happened for New Brunswick, when it happened for Saskatchewan, etc. There are local community groups, both in like larger cities such as Calgary and Edmonton, talking about like, say, Queer Citizens United, about the Walls Down Collective, about trans rights YG, about Pride Corner White, you know, all these other groups that have taken amazing strides in order to make sure at the grassroots level that these policies be untenable. You're seeing protests by the thousands for trans rights, which used to never happen in Alberta. This is pretty much a first. So we're seeing a lot of people getting mobilized. Whether it's going to have a meaningful impact, though, depends on whether it's going to become politically untenable for Danielle Smith to proceed with these anti-trans policies. There used to be a time where introducing such policies would basically be political suicide because you're attacking a marginalized group's human rights. It would not be acceptable. That's exactly what happened in North Carolina back in 2016 with their bathroom bill. It ended up having such economic repercussions on the state that it ended up being repealed. So unfortunately, I don't really see a way out unless it's for this very economic argument of Alberta losing out so much to the point where they end up becoming a pariah province. I really hope it doesn't get there and like we can have Danielle Smith actually voluntarily withdraw these proposed legislative changes. But unfortunately, I think that might be the only way forward.
Interesting that you said that North Carolina basically had faced economic repercussions. Have you ever heard of something like BDS happening? Like some sort of boycott, economic or otherwise, yeah. Not even grassroots level, but by other provinces?
Yeah, and sadly, these have not had enough of an impact, I'll be honest. So for example, despite Florida being such an unsafe state for people to go to, so there is a trans bathroom ban there, or like even using the bathroom at the airport or in any public building can land you in jail for a year. It is very much a place where no trans person should go to. It is rated as do not travel by major American organizations as well as trans activists. Yet, we're still seeing so many parts of their tourism industry still thrive as per usual. You still get advertisements on Air Canada for going to Florida. Disney World still does its advertisements a little bit everywhere. We are not seeing people standing up for trans rights when it comes to this. And I very much believe that a boycott-centered approach towards making sure that anti-trans policies are economically unsustainable, these need to form part of a broader strategy down the line. Even though I will admit, the purchasing power, the economic power of the trans community itself is extremely limited because of how much we're already marginalized. We're going to need way more solidarity than this.
Even if the economic purchasing power of the trans community is small, the trans community is a community that would absolutely benefit from the solidarity and the allyship of many other like marginalized groups, many of the groups who have had their charter rights attacked.
Absolutely. Like, say, the unions or the rest of the rainbow, you know?
I guess looking forward, and we touched on this a bit, the fact that trans issues are becoming a focal point in Canadian politics. We're actually quite far out from the next election for normal people, but it's like, I guess, 2025, so a year. And so for people in politics, that's actually very soon. Pierre Poilievre, the leader of the Federal Conservatives, he's defended Danielle Smith's policies, and he said that he opposes the use of puberty blockers. So it's not crazy at all to predict that trans issues and gender identity are going to be hot button issues in the next election. How do you see things shaping up?
I'm seeing more and more just fear within the trans community. And I'm afraid that unfortunately, the 2025 elections are going to be very much determinative of whether we get to live with our full human dignity and human rights down the line. It is looking to be pretty scary. It's like, you have to wonder, how's it going to go for us? So I very much expect trans issues to become a pretty major talking point. I expect federal parties, notably the Liberals and the NDP, but I'd say especially the latter, to benefit from the trans votes per se. But at the same time, I very much see like this becoming a pretty major campaigning point for both of the aforementioned parties, while potentially anti-trans policies being more explicitly campaigned for by the Conservatives. But this is like something that unfortunately it's going to become very much such a politicized issue, just like how abortion was 40 years ago. And I'm afraid that's something that people are going to be willing to like sell out our human rights for like lower taxes or other such like perceived benefits. That's how the impact instantly for sure. But most likely between now and then, we'll see more provincial initiatives, more and more provincial governments positioning themselves either explicitly for or explicitly against trans justice. And all of this is going to shape us up for a pretty frightening election period, I'll be honest.
So you mentioned that it might be a sticking point for non-conservatives like the NDP, the Liberals, the Green Party. Are there any sorts of political mobilization or organizing by the trans community within any of the major political parties that you're aware of right now?
Unlike many of the parties, such as like the Liberals, mostly like through the government, as well as the NDP, they're trying to connect more with trans voters and like step up with them, meet them and help determine policies alongside that. That's how, say, for example, there's currently a petition going online with launched by my friend Faye Johnstone, specifically demanding that the NDP's white paper on trans issues gets implemented in Canadian federal legislation. So it's a lot of these initiatives are beginning to take a much bigger role. And I believe eventually we're going to see more and more trans legislation be introduced in Parliament at the federal level. So of course there's going to be that.
Well, it's good to know that people like Faye and there's people out there fighting the good fight.
Exactly.
Well, Celeste, thank you for joining us.
It's a pleasure.
If you like what you've heard on The Breach Show, please subscribe to the podcast or our YouTube channel. And if you want to support our work, please become a sustaining member to help us produce more journalism for transformation. You can do that at breachmedia.ca/support. Thanks for listening.